everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. It's time for It's All About Food. And here we are. It's July 1st, 2014. Wow. I'm saying wow because here in New York City, we just got through a beautiful month of June, and every day was an incredible surprise for me because I don't think there was any humidity this month, or not much of it. And my memory of June is a hot, painful one. And it's just been delicious. Do you not agree with me? Back in 2002 to 2006, I organized every summer in June a vegan festival. It was a big one. It was on the campus of Lincoln Center. It was called Taste of Health. Maybe some of you remember it. It was a wonderful event, but every time we had it, it was hot. And so many people complained about the heat and the humidity. I picked June back then because it was available, but also I wanted to have less of the risk of rain, and it never did rain for those events. But just thinking back on those hot, humid days and just getting through this delicious month of June, I am so grateful. And how do we continue to have wonderful weather like this? Well, let's see what July will bring. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Now I want to talk more about food, my favorite subject, with my guest today, Charles Horn. He's the author of Meat Logic, Why Do We Eat Animals? He's an Emmy-nominated writer and producer with credits including Forget About It, Robot Chicken, and Robot Chicken Star Wars. He has a PhD in electrical engineering from Princeton University and holds 5 degrees in engineering and mathematics. Charles, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good. So we're going to talk about your book and whatever else we feel like talking about in the next half hour or so. And you have 5 degrees in engineering and mathematics. I'm sure you're a logical guy.
Well, I try to be.
And is that was that some of what inspired you in writing Meat Logic, because your mind thinks the way it does, or has been trained to think the way it does?
Well, I mean, I guess that's the case. I mean, how it sort of started was I was just watching a lot of people who argue on Facebook.
You know? Oh, gosh, there's a lot of violence on Facebook,
yeah.
Isn't there?
And they would just, like, have the same kinds of arguments, and it would just repeat over and over again and kind of end in the same ways. And I was just, like, thinking, well, why isn't there a place where this is all, you know, why isn't this done already? Why isn't there a place where you can just go and just once and for all kind of have this? And so that's sort of how I got the idea for the book. It started off actually to be something completely different, because I have a background now in comedy as well. And originally I was going to make it a comedic book. And I started actually kind of doing that, where I would, like, be answering the same types of questions, but I'd be doing it in a comedic way.
Yeah.
And it became clear pretty quick that while it could be funny, it really wouldn't be effective, because the reader would take this as an attack. And I was, like, writing for the wrong audience if I were to do it completely comedically. So it became clear that I actually couldn't do the comedic approach. I sort of had to just go a more straightforward, logical approach, because people are just we've been trained to think a certain way based on our society for, you know, thousands of years. And so we're at this level where we can't even think properly on the subject.
Yep. We can't think properly. That's a good one.
Yeah, so that's sort of what it became about. it became sort of like not just, you know, hey, you're wrong kind of thing, but just, hey, let's think about this for a second. Let's not even, you know, tackle your question itself, but let's tackle how you're thinking about the problem. And so, you know, maybe I can illustrate that here's a way of looking at it that's different, and here's a way that you can look at it in comparison to other situations where you already know how to think better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this book is really helpful for people who are already there that are vegan and need to have some good comeback arguments when they're posed with these things that we hear over and over and over and over, just as a starting point. Because often, I mean, we hear these, all of the things that you brought up in the book, and we'll probably go over some of them. We hear them over and over, and sometimes we don't have the right response.
Yeah.
Or we don't know what the right response is. Or sometimes, even though we've heard some of these things over and over, it still hits us. We're dumbfounded when we hear it. Like, really? Really? I was at a book signing event maybe a month ago at Moo Shoes, which is a vegan shoe store in Manhattan. And the owners of that shoe store, they're two lovely sisters, and they are very generous with their space, and there's a lot of book signing and other vegan events there. And I was there. It was for Gene Stone's newest book that he co-authored called Awareness, I think it's called.
Uh-huh.
And I just walked in, and I'm, like, scoping out who I know and checking out the free samples of vegan food. And I overheard this guy say, "Oh, really? Where do you get your protein?" And I thought, that guy's got to be kidding, right? We're at a vegan event. Mostly everybody's vegan. And so I looked at him because I had just passed him, and I said, "You're not serious, right?" It turns out he was. He was a friend of the author. He was not vegetarian, and he was sincerely asking, "Where do you get your protein?" You didn't talk about that in your book, fortunately. That's, like, such an overdone question. But, you know, we never know where the questions are going to be asked and what they're going to be, and it's always good to have the answers. So thank you for providing some very logical responses.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, no, I actually, you're right. The protein question was something that I sort of, you know, the one type of response would be to actually give them the information of, hey, here's all the different plant-based sources of getting your protein. But I sort of wanted to take a broader step than that. So, like, you know, I'll point you to a book that has more info about vegan nutrition and, you know, nutrition, period. But I wanted to talk about, like, a broader issue of, you know, a lot of people aren't ready to even believe things. So
mm-hmm.
we could say, hey, here's where you get your protein, and think that we're done with the question. But we're actually not, because there's still a block on their end where they're not believing, you know, us in any way. So I kind of wanted to tackle those questions, those hypothetical questions of, well, you know, what if it were true that we actually needed to eat animals? How would it change how we would go about things? And so by tackling that type of broader question, I kind of wanted to show them that, in a sense, even if you were hypothetically right, you're still thinking about it in the wrong way. And so I want to get them thinking that, you know what, it's not a vegan versus status quo. You have no status quo. There's no, you know, it doesn't exist. So whatever you're going to think, you have to think different at this point. So, you know, I kind of wanted to address those things.
In a number of chapters, you end with a summary and use the abusive boyfriend as a comparison. Can you give some examples of that, or why you decided to use that guy?
Yeah.
You know, there are some abusive girlfriends out there too, but
there are, yes, but it's more well known. And
there are more abusive boyfriends out there than girlfriends.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to point out that some of these things that people say, if you actually analyze them and you really, you know, take them apart, you can see how, like, the person is basically saying, I'm only hurting you because I love you so much. And it's like, you know, think about that for a second. This is exactly, you know, that's the abusive boyfriend situation, you know. So I kind of wanted people to see that this is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's still hard. It's still hard for them to see that.
Yeah.
Very hard. Which is why we need so many books and so many more restaurants and so many more cookbooks. And people need to hear this information and have it be front and center in front it all the time. And it's improving. But they need to be bombarded with this information from so many different angles.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Most of the time, people don't really have to even think about it. So, because it's the social norm, so it's kind of tough for us vegans to, you know, we want to force them to think about it. But then that puts us in the situation of being, you know, thought of as the aggressor, and so it's a tough situation where they take life around them as normal, you know, but then are never forced to think about this.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to talk about the image that many of us have of being preachy. You talked a little bit about it in the book. It's hard not to sound preachy. It's hard not to sound smug.
Yeah.
Even if you're presenting logic that seems so obvious, it still sounds to those who don't agree that we're the high and mighty.
Yeah, that's very true. I tried very hard in the book to not be that, you know, that type. Like, I would constantly rewrite it if I ever felt it was, you know, going in that direction. But yeah, if it's just a natural thing that basically we're going to be in that situation because they willfully don't want to think about this. The only way to change is forcing them to think about this. And so you're in a dilemma, and it's basically the same thing that other social justice issues went through in the past, where people didn't like them, but now we consider them normal and heroes. You
right.
know,
for... George Washington was a terrorist.
Yeah.
To the Brits back
exactly.
then.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hindsight. To know what people will think of us in 50 or 100 or even 20 years.
Yeah.
I look forward to that. But
yes.
I don't know that I'll know. So I've been doing this for a long time. I don't know about you. And I started as a teenager, and I was a bit abrasive in my younger days. I worked as an engineer for 20 years in the semiconductor industry, and any opportunity I could, I was preaching about the power of vegetables. I was never shy. And I've since learned that the softer, more loving, compassionate approach works better. And I tend not to preach, especially when I'm eating with people. But I found I don't bring it up. I've made like a personal thing with myself. I don't bring it up. But everybody knows who knows me, what I'm about. They all feel like guilty or something when we're eating together. And they bring it up. They bring up a question. I was having a lunch with some people the other day, and one of them said, I don't understand what's wrong with eating eggs. You know, if a chicken just leaves it, what's wrong with eating it? And it just started a whole conversation. And I'm open when people want to ask the question. But what I find is a lot of people that are eating animals are either subconsciously or consciously are uncomfortable with it, and they have to talk about it.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I think you're right in saying that just the fact that we kind of exist is already something that makes them, you know, feel awkward. And I think, you know, a lot of people find when they actually go vegan is, you know, that it's important to find other vegans because a lot of people just can't deal with it, you know, who
yep.
aren't vegan. And
yep.
and you need that those other people. Like, I'm sure you must have friends or, you know, that stopped inviting you to things.
Yeah.
Because, you know, things like that. You know, it's, you know, as if you're going to go to their home and be like, you know, pointing fingers and, you know. It's funny, but there's that sense of just already it's an awkward situation.
Well, I think the bigger part of that is that most people, at least the people that I know who are very busy and usually a two-person adult family, they both work, they don't know how to prepare food, any kind of food, and they're used to eating out or bringing in. And my partner Gary and I, we're both big into cooking our own food. We post a lot of recipes at my nonprofit website, responsibleeateatingandliving.com. People are intimidated with us, vegan or not. We know how to make food. So many people don't, which is why when they know people that are vegan, they don't even know what's in their food to know what to eliminate.
Yeah, that's true too. I mean, I'm actually not in the same case as you. I'm a guy who doesn't know how to cook very
yeah,
well, you know.
Well, most people are like that today.
Yeah, exactly. So,
so tell me, where do you go to eat and what do you eat?
Well, I'm lucky that I live in Los Angeles and there's a, you know, burgeoning number of restaurants and it's wonderful. I actually I was a longtime vegetarian and only 2 years ago I finally went vegan. I find that my palate has expanded enormously.
Isn't that that's just amazing, and I laugh every time I hear it.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Well, because it's like we put ourselves in these boxes, and by finally making a change, you kind of take that opportunity of saying, well, now I'm giving myself permission to try all these new things.
Mm.
And, you know, I just would rule those things out before, but now it's like, hey, you know, this is great. I'll just try these things.
When you don't have the crutch of grating salty, fatty cheese on everything, all of a sudden your taste buds get clean, and then you're open to new flavors.
Yeah.
Now, you talk a little bit about the excuses that people give to themselves, whether they're vegetarian or flexitarian. What were you telling yourself when you were vegetarian?
Well, basically, a lot of it is, I think, similar to a lot of vegetarians who are ethical vegetarians. They don't know better. Like, here's somebody like me who has 5 degrees, has got a
yep.
PhD from Princeton. I did not know that you have to make a cow pregnant to
mm-hmm.
get milk. I mean, that's
yep.
embarrassing.
But, you know, I remember watching Sesame Street as a kid. I was actually about 9 or 10, and I was watching with my baby brother. But I still enjoyed it at that age. And they said, I'll never forget this, but there were these beautiful images of cows. And it said, a cow makes much too much milk for her young calf to drink. I'll never forget those words, exactly those words. And we were taught that milk is extra,
yeah.
and it's for us.
Yeah, cows give milk.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we take it. Cows give milk.
All right,
yeah.
So how did you discover that cows needed to become pregnant and make calves to make milk and all the things that are associated with that aren't so nice?
You know, I don't remember the exact moments. I mean, I know that basically as a vegetarian, I basically knew that I want no part of this, but I didn't want to think about it any further because I felt that I can't win this fight. So I don't want to think about this every day. I want out, but you know, I don't want to think about it anymore. So that's sort of how I was for many years. And then I guess more recently I've been feeling that, you know what, things are starting to move, and I kind of want to be a part of that. I want to push it in the right direction, however little I can.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I was more open to you know, learning more and you know, looking for how to replace the remaining few things that were vegetarian in my diet.
And where are your friends and colleagues on this? Are they bummed out that you're becoming more of a drag, or are they happy?
I definitely have lost some Facebook friends.
Facebook too.
And you know, I sort of, I guess, part of me just thinks that it's necessary. Like, if that's what's going to happen, it's going to happen. And but it's more important for me to speak the truth. And I kind of think that we are getting closer and closer, you know, to a point where more and more people are being open to hearing it.
Yeah.
So I think that that's more important to me at this point. So whatever consequences there are, you know, if that's still worth it. And I'm also looking now for ways to turn it into a positive in other ways, you know, for both, you know, both for myself as well. Like, for example, I, you know, have been writing comedy. Well, hey, maybe I could find a way to be doing some, you know, some entertainment.
Absolutely. I think it's really important to do that. I was going to say, when you were originally talking in the beginning, how you decided to make your book serious rather than comedic, there's a place for the comedy, too. We need it. We need a message everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's sort of two kind of things I want to do. And I mean, obviously, it's something that would take funding and all that, so I haven't.
Oh, that.
Mm. Yeah, so I haven't fully figured it out. But there's like, I'd love to, on the one hand, do, you know, one of those Stephen Colbert type shows,
mm-hmm.
where you're just kind of showing the insanity by just.
Yes.
Right. Treating it.
Yes, we need that. And we've been toying with that idea, too, at my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living. So we need more of that. We need it, period. Yes.
And then the other thing I wanted to do is, you know, I write a lot of sitcoms as well, and I kind of want to do just like the comparison to The Cosby Show, where I just want that family that's normal, but they're vegan.
Yeah, oh,
and it's just,
love it. Yes.
So,
right.
Yeah, I want to do that as well.
You know, for me, it's a big picture. I'm against racism, homophobism, speciesism, all those isms, whatever. I want to eliminate pain and suffering, and let's get away from exploitation. Big picture, everything applies. But unfortunately, history has shown us that we take very baby steps, and we're not even there. In places where we think we've gotten far, like with women's rights or with civil rights, we still have slaves around the world and in this country, although it may not be that apparent to people, or semi-slaves. People recognize it's horrible, but these things still exist. So we move slowly in improving women's rights and people of color and wherever we can minimize exploitation, and animals seem to be less because they don't have a voice.
Yeah, and that's true, but there is one important difference, and we're kind of seeing it as we speak in terms of the LGBT, is that like, we can see in our lifetime how even though they're not fully there yet,
yeah,
it's turning the corner where it's not going to go back. Like, you do get that sense that,
yes,
okay,
absolutely,
we have turned that corner.
It's inevitable. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's frustrating, but inevitable.
Yes. but
and
for
television
animals,
and the sitcoms have helped that.
That's true.
That's why we need you to write one.
I have one. It needs funding.
Oh, funding. I'm so tired of that. We have created so much from nothing just because of funding is just so hard.
I know.
Yeah. All right. A few more minutes. So tell me about some of these things in your bio, Robot Chicken. What's
yes.
Robot Chicken about? Is there any good veg messages in there, or is it just a nice, funny story?
No, it's like these other projects are like I'm one writer on a team of writers, so
mm-hmm.
I'm not in charge of these. Robot Chicken, Seth Green is one of the people behind it. It's basically a stop motion animation sketch comedy show. So they take like little puppets and they move them frame by
mm-hmm.
frame.
Love that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they just make pop culture jokes and all that. So it has a really strong cult following. It's on Adult Swim at night. It's for adults.
Okay.
So that's a lot of fun. But no, unfortunately, the other, most of the writers are not are not there yet. So
right. I remember hearing, I may get this wrong, but something about the movie Finding Nemo was like the most popular video or the most watched something or other. And I was surprised to hear that it was as popular as it was, especially because whether people realize it or not, there was that subliminal or not so subliminal vegan message with the sharks trying not to eat other fish.
Yeah. Yeah, there are. I think we're seeing, I remember hearing a story about they changed the script in where they were going to end it at SeaWorld, and they actually changed a script where they took that out because they realized that where we're going long term, SeaWorld just won't stand up to history.
Right, SeaWorld is not very nice these days, or
no.
any of those days, but they're getting a very bad animal treatment reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah, because fish have feelings too, and
yeah.
mammal and sea mammals have feelings too.
I know. There's still a lot of misinformation out there. There's still a lot of work to do. But, more and more people are like getting to that point where they know something's wrong and they realize, society should, it's time. It's time. So.
Right. Okay. We're pretty much at the end. I just wanted to run through the table of contents of your book just to whet people's appetite about what they can find in your book in terms of the information that they need when people are going to hit them with some of the responses that you talk about. So we've got bias and misconceptions, the philosophical basis for animal rights, a few problems with arguments for speciesism, animals are just things, animals don't feel pain, animals are dumb, animals aren't human, humans are omnivores, like we're supposed to be eating flesh. There's some good ones here. We've been eating meat since the beginning of time. You talk about the paleo diet, which is so amusing to me. All of the excuses for paleo. And it's not a good diet, hello. The only thing good about the paleo diet is it gets people away from eating processed and junk food.
Right.
Period. But the rest of it, forget about it. bacon is one of your chapters. The role of farm animals is to be eaten. Death at slaughterhouse is better than death in the wild. Who thinks of these things? A lot of people do. I was brought up eating animals. It's tradition. I certainly know that one. And the animal is already dead, and God gave us the right to eat animals, please. Yeah, so very good. You hit them all pretty much, and thank you for writing it.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Charles, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad to meet you.
You too.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Bye.
You're welcome. That was fun. Meat logic. why do we eat animals? And if you are eating animals, maybe you could give me your logic as to why you are, because I'd like to hear about it and we can have a nice conversation, because the only way we're going to move forward is to communicate and communicate with each other. You may remember I recently spoke to 250 cattle ranchers about climate change in Nevada, and it was so powerful because here were two groups of people. Well, me, the lone vegan, one person, and 250 other people. But we were going back and forth and sharing our thoughts and ideas, and it's the only way we're going to move forward is when we talk and communicate and stay open. Hello, everybody. I'm back. It's the second half of our July 1st, 2014 show. It's all about food. Now, I didn't mention a few things before I left for the break, and that is if you do want to have a dialogue with me about meat, the logic of eating meat, or anything else about food, you can email me at info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. Also, I talked about talking to those 250 cattle ranchers the last time I was on this show 2 weeks ago. I mentioned that we had just released our documentary, and as Charles Horn and I were just talking about, it takes a lot of funding to do stuff and to make things happen. And I just want to say we created this 70-minute documentary with no funding, no help from anybody. But we just thought that this story of one lonely vegan going to talk to 250 cattle ranchers was too important not to tell. And if you have seen it already, thank you very much for watching. Please let me know what you thought of it. And if you have not seen it yet, please find the time to take 70 minutes and watch it. Join our community. Come into our living room. Listen to our conversation and let us know what you think. I would really, really appreciate it. So to find the film, you just go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my nonprofit website, and the link's right there on the homepage. The Lone Vegan Preaching to the Choir. And then once you've seen it, share it. I've gotten so many wonderful responses about this film already, and what I love most is hearing people's ideas, their thoughts, their dreams of what they would like to see in the world. Communities of people growing fresh, locally grown food, supporting each other, finding ways to make that happen and make it work for so many people and where more people can benefit. We'll see where that goes. Okay, so last week I missed the show, and I'll tell you why. I was in Boston, and I wanted to tell you about my trip to Boston. But it starts actually in New York, so where I come from, where I live. I had purchased a Groupon not too long ago, which was, what was it? It was $15 for $30 worth of food at Westerly. Now, Westerly is a health food store in Manhattan. It's one of my favorites. They have a great selection of dark leafy green vegetables, my favorite foods. And what I did was I just went over there with my Groupon and I stuffed my bags with dark leafy green vegetables and came home. And then I realized that I was heading up to Boston because I had a friend from Costa Rica who was bringing her sons to some summer programs in Boston, and I had a friend from France who was bringing her granddaughter to a program, summer program in Boston, and I had all these fresh, dark leafy greens to deal with. Well, the first thing I did, I realized I was going to take one of these buses from Manhattan to Boston, and maybe you know about them, but some of them are really inexpensive, so I took like a $13 Bolt bus to Boston, which was really quite pleasant, and it's like a 4-hour, 15-minute ride, but I had to take the subway first to get there. I knew I was going to be hungry. So I made a giant, and I mean giant, big bowl of fresh arugula and watercress with some chopped black, wrinkly, dry olives, flax seeds, and a lovely tahini dressing. And I took this big bowl with me. It's light, but big. And on the bus, I ate this giant salad. Actually, I had some at the beginning of the trip, like a breakfast, and then I finished it up towards the end of the trip. Well, I'm bringing it up because the entire day in Boston, walking around in the warm, hot weather, no humidity, take note, I was so satisfied. I wasn't hungry all day. It was incredible because I had filled up on these nutrient-dense, dark leafy green vegetables. And I eat a lot of salads, but you can always eat more, I think. And it always surprises me how powerful they are at energizing, giving you what you need for so little calories. It was spectacular. So I was fueled for a wonderful day, and I walked around with my friend, and I didn't need to eat until later in the evening. It was great. So then I met up with my friend from Costa Rica, and then later I met up with my friend from France, and just it was so wonderful being in Boston. I'm always delightful to discover wonderful food. Since I was with my French friend, who's not vegetarian, I wanted to be respectful of her and her choices. So I kept telling her she can go wherever she wants. And also, we were in a very touristy area, and after walking around in all the heat, you don't want to go and look for a new restaurant. So a couple of times we ended up going to some very touristy kind of places. But every time I was so delighted to discover great food. And I want to just tell you about some of them. So one place was Sweet Green. And I discovered it's a chain. Maybe you've heard about it. So this is in the Back Bay area of Boston, where there's a lot of students. And what was so exciting about this place, okay, this is not fine dining, but this is a place where there was this long queue, this long line of young people online ordering big salads. I was so excited. Young people wanting their greens and eating their vegetables. How exciting is that? I thought it was great. We got our big salads and ate them. They were really great. They were fresh. This isn't a vegan place. You can put your cheese and animal toppings on top, but there were lots of wonderful options and some really creative flavors. This was great. Now, I personally prefer when I'm eating either in my home or at a picnic or anywhere at a party. I'm not into throwaway dishes and forks. When we have a picnic or something, we bring cloth napkins and reusable plates and things. I just have a thing against throwaway stuff because it's not so environmentally friendly, and I just think it gives it a quality feeling when you're using real plates. And certainly at home, when we have parties, we're always using real plates. Real. I'm about real, right? Responsible eating and living, R-E-A-L. Well, this particular place had what looked like plastic bowls for the salads and plastic utensils. So when one of the young managers came over, wanted to know how we were doing, and I was saying how wonderful everything was, I did mention that I wasn't so excited about the bowls and utensils. And then he said, well, they're compostable. The bowls, which look like plastic, were made from sugar cane, and the utensils were made from cornstarch. So not the ideal, but pretty good. And that was fun to learn about. And also kind of a reflection on myself, assuming the worst, and getting a little annoyed and trying to contain my frustration and then learning that it wasn't as bad as I thought. Always learning. Then someone at the hotel, we wanted to experience some of the Italian area, the northern part of Boston where there's a big Italian space of lots of Italian restaurants and very touristy. Again, I wasn't going to give my input. We went to a place that the manager at the hotel recommended, a place called Brico. And we were sitting there, and I was looking at the menu thinking, oh, my goodness, there is nothing for me. And the waiter came over. He was quite pleasant, but the entire time I spoke with him, I just felt that he didn't understand me. Do you ever get that when you're somewhere in a restaurant or somewhere? Either they have an attitude that they're not paying attention or that what you're saying doesn't compute. He always had a smile on his face, but I just thought, oh, what I'm saying, where I don't want to have eggs or dairy, and can he make me a vegetable plate and make sure it's not sautéed with chicken broth? And I rarely have to have that conversation these days because there's vegan food everywhere. And when we finished our order, I said to my friend, I'm not sure what we're going to get here. But it turned out perfectly. I was served this beautiful, beautiful plate of very, very lovely fresh vegetables, which included broccoli rabe and asparagus and some gorgeous mushrooms. I think they were porcini. They were just so fabulous. And there were a couple of, I'll call them schmears, a couple of dips for the bread, and one of them was like a hummus, and the waiter came over really quickly. He said, you can't have this one because it has pork in it. And I was a little disappointed that I couldn't have it, but so delighted that he took the time to tell me. And I knew at that point that I was so wrong. He heard me and he understood me. And I'm just glad that whole time that I kept a very courteous, friendly demeanor and didn't get angry at any point, because that's not the way to be, and you can be wrong. So twice during this trip, I really read people wrong. We also ate at a place called City Landing, which is also kind of a touristy spot near the pier, near the Long Wharf. And they have a beautiful menu. They have vegetarian and vegan items and gluten-free. It's all spelled out on the menu. That was fun. And then the other place was a place called Sail Loft. And this was one of these typical seafood on the water kind of places, dark wood and rustic. And they had a very friendly stir-fry vegetable dish with a rice pilaf, and they guaranteed to me that it was vegan, and it was great. So there's a lot of things to rejoice about. Our message is being heard around. More restaurants are including, if not one more than one, healthy vegan item on their menu. And that way, we can all get along together. So that was a really nice trip. And I'm reminded that I really like to have big green salads for breakfast because they're so, so satisfying. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about today is the linden tree. Are you familiar with the linden tree? One of the things that I love about June, I know it's July 1st, but it started in the end of June, is the linden tree blooms, and it lasts for about a week, and it usually happens here in New York City in June. And what I love about it is the fragrance of this tree is, in my opinion, intoxicating. I've been drunk all week, just high all week, on the fabulous fragrance of the linden tree. And one of the things that I just discovered, I was with my friend from France in Boston, speaking French for 2 days, reminiscing about the lovely times when I lived in the south of France in the early 90s. When I did live there in the Provence region, whenever you would go to a restaurant and ask for an herb tea, there were three flavors, either mint, verveine, which is verbena, kind of a lemony flavor, and something called tilleul. And the tilleul was typically, in most restaurants, not a... there, everybody. Well, I just got lost in my linden tree love conversation, and I'm not exactly sure where I stopped, but was talking about the linden tree and how I used to drink the tiule when I lived in the south of France. It was a very popular herb tea, and I never knew that the tiule tea was actually the flowers from the linden tree. And this was so exciting for me to learn just the other day. Now, all I want to do, there's a linden tree right outside from my terrace, and it's got these wonderful flowers, and like I said, it only lasts about a week, and I think today is probably going to be the last day or tomorrow where we get this great fragrance. But what I really want to do is to clip some of those flowers from the tree and use as tea. I'm not quite sure how to do that because the tree is kind of tall and it's not close enough for my terrace to grab. If anybody has any recommendations, let me know. But there's some wonderful qualities in the linden tea, which I now know is tiule in France. It's considered a light and lively blend of fragrant flowers and leaves, the actual tea, and it's caffeine-free. It has a mild digestive quality, and it has sleep benefits. So it's sort of like, I guess, like chamomile. So not only does it have this phenomenal intoxicating fragrance, but you can have the tea all year long, and it has some nice health benefits. So somehow I'm going to try and grab those flowers from that tree and make some tiule tea, linden tree tea. All right, just a few more minutes, and I wanted to just give some hot weather tips, things that may be obvious to you, maybe some things you're doing. Maybe you have some tips for me. Again, you can email me at info@realmeals.org. First, number one, drink, drink, drink. We want to keep hydrating in this weather for those of us who are in hot weather. And you know me, I like clean water. So here at home, we've got a filter system where we're regularly changing the filter, and then on top of that, I distill my water. I really believe in drinking clean water, distilled water. And if you want information about distilled water, it's always there at responsibleeatingandliving.com, a link to distilled water and the company that makes the one that I recommend most, Aquany. And if you have any questions, you can always email me, info@realmeals.org, about water. But what we do here is we distill our water, filter and distill our water, and put them in glass bottles. I don't like plastic, even if it's plastic made of sugar cane. And most of them I store in the refrigerator in the summer, so the water is nice and chilled whenever I want it. And I like to store things in glass. Just recently, I was given a wonderful gift, which is a glass bottle that has a kind of like a rubbery holder on it, so if you drop it, it doesn't break. And this I take with me whenever I'm going somewhere instead of bringing water in plastic. This way I have my phenomenally clean, delicious water, and I can take it with me all around. So if you see those, I highly recommend them. And for fun treats that are cool, frozen blueberries. Have you ever just popped a frozen blueberry in your mouth? It's the best frozen popsicle, only they're like in little bites, and they're just blueberries. So if you ever see a great deal on blueberries at a farmer's market or wherever you are, certainly it's great to have them fresh. But if you get a lot of them, you can freeze some of them, and they're wonderful frozen. They're great in smoothies and all kinds of things, but I just like popping them. Kids like them, too. Great little treat, frozen blueberries. And the other thing is frozen melons. So if when they're ripe and when they're ready and when they're inexpensive, this is a great time to buy a lot of them. And you can take the melon meat, blend it up in a blender, and then pour them in popsicle containers or any little containers that you can have, even in an ice cube tray. They make great little fresh, refreshing sweet treats, all natural, minimally processed, delicious. One more thing. Maybe one more thing. I think I may have a few more things, but nuts, okay? Raw nuts and seeds, they're really important. They have a lot of great minerals, a lot of great nutrition, and we want to eat some every day. Not a lot, but just enough, an ounce or two. They make everything taste better, a little sprinkled on your oatmeal or sprinkled on your salads. But you want to keep them in the refrigerator, or if you have a lot of them in the freezer, they go rancid, and you don't want that to happen. You want your nuts and seeds fresh. And how good do they taste when they have that fresh taste? They are so good. Please keep them cool so that they don't go bad. And now in the summer, for those of us experiencing summer, if your house isn't air-conditioned all the time, it's important to keep those foods that are affected by heat or warm weather, keep them cool. And that's the same with grains and flours. I keep all of my grains and flours in the refrigerator, in glass jars. Hello. And I was just talking about water. I have to admit, I'm not a fan of plain water. The only time I eat, the only time I drink plain water is usually when I'm at a restaurant and the food is too salty, so I have to wash it down all the time. When I'm eating at home, I don't usually drink water when I'm eating because I don't salt my food and I don't seem to have a need for it. But when I do drink during the day, I like a little flavor in my water. I use a number of things to flavor. You know, squeezing little lemon juice is great, or a little lime juice. But sometimes I've used lemon juice and lime juice for something else. I save the skins. Now, I always buy organic. But if you save the rind of the lemon or the lime or an orange, they're great twisted in water. You can leave them for the day, and it gets a lovely flavor. And you get some of those great flavonoids and things that are in the rind that are really good for you, and they taste great. And then another thing, which I got from the French, and it's the last thing I'm going to say before I go, is herbs are lovely in water, either hot or cold. I love a fresh thyme tea, and it doesn't even have to be fresh. It can be dried, where you make a tea of just thyme and water. It can be, you can have it warm or you can have it cold. Why not? We put mint in water sometimes, and mint is great, but try some of the other herbs. So good. Just a light suggestion is just a lovely experience. All right? Well, that's all for today. That's the end of the program. And next week, we've got two wonderful guests. I wanted to let you know, Jeffrey Cohen from the Jewish Vegetarians of North America. He's known as the Beet Eating Heap. He's got a blog called the Beet Eating Heap. And then we've got Stephen Wise, who's the founder of the Non-Human Rights Project. He's been in the news quite a lot, and he's got a wonderful legal process going on where he's working to get rights for chimpanzees and other animals. And it's so exciting, his work. And we're going to hear a little bit about that next week. Well, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. And remember to watch the Lone Vegan documentary at responsibleeatingandliving.com. And have a delicious week.